Last night at the coffee house was a spectacular brew occasion, as so often occurs, and I was talking to a couple of you about how sometimes stories are just as true as facts. How sometimes stories tell us things about ourselves that historical recitations just can't do. And that stories capture truths about human life and human yearning that evidence can't always uncover. That story that is the framework of our sermon today, the exodus of the Hebrew people and their quest for a holy land promised them by a God they love, this land flowing with milk and honey. It is just such a story that in some ways is more true than a fact. It's more true than history because it captures a yearning that they and we and all people everywhere really share. It's a yearning for a place and a time, a life wherein everything will finally be as it ought to be. It's a yearning for all the stuff that's broken to finally get fixed. It's a yearning to finally be where you feel at home, be where you belong. That yearning, as we know, also comes paired with a struggle we all share. A struggle we share with people everywhere and from every age. That struggle is captured in the fact that the promised land, no matter if you think of that literally or metaphorically, the promised land is never very easy to get to. It was certainly true of this particular promised land. If you look at a map of the Sinai Peninsula, which is where the Israelites were supposed to have fled from Egypt into modern-day Israel, it seems like it ought to be pretty easy to get from Pharaoh's lands in Egypt to what we know now as Israel. If anybody had stopped to ask directions, say, it would have been a piece of cake. They might have said something like, follow the coastline. Look at the enormous body of water and stay near it. If they could have done that, just that, maybe it wouldn't have been so hard. But the Hebrews didn't ask directions, or if they did, it was from a God who left them wandering in the wilderness for an entire generation. And finally, when they got about as lost as is humanly and conceivably possible for people to get, finally, when most of them had given up at some point along the journey and almost starved and made God all mad because they were all unfaithful and unruly and perhaps a bit squirrely, finally, after all of this, a generation, they found themselves on the edge of this land they had hoped for so long. And that's where Moses left them. At the end of the Exodus, this leader, Moses, of this hopelessly directionless but powerfully driven people, this leader looks over the vast stretching lands from the vantage point of a high mountain peak. He sees all he has hungered for, what he risked it all for, what all these people have been following him around for generations for. He sees in the distance the realization of a promise, and then he dies. The story tells us that Moses got a glimpse of the promised land on that high mountain and that he would go no further. God's own hands dug his grave. And supposedly he is there. Somewhere he is there. In the secret isolation on the edge of a promise. But the people go on in the story. They follow a new leader and they march off, leaving that mountain, that high, lonely place of Moses' death behind them. Of course, we know now that the promised land flowing with milk and honey didn't turn out to be exactly what the Hebrew people were expecting. It was hard scrabble earth. It was tough farming. And in the biggest surprise of all, though perhaps they should have been prepared, some folks already lived there. The promised land was previously inhabited, and thus begins a struggle that has never ended. For the Hebrew people, the promised land would be a land of hunger as much as a land of glory, a land of warfare, and a land of continual starting over. Every time it seemed God's promise was almost fulfilled, that perfect state of harmony and abundance would slip back over the edge of the horizon, and only a few people of every age with extraordinary vision could climb mountains high enough to still see hope there in the distance. First, they had to walk in the wilderness for a generation. Then Moses, the man who'd gotten them into this mess in the first place, up and died. Then finally, when they get there, it wasn't what they'd planned. Given this story, I'm sure someone wondered, couldn't God both have given us better directions and hooked us up with some better real estate? Location is everything. And the promised land, both literally and metaphorically, has always been far away from everything. And yet, upon thinking about it, I imagine that it is in the very nature of a promised land to be far, far away. From Odysseus's labors to return to Ithaca, to Spanish conquistadors coming to the New World seeking a fountain of youth, to Mormons who caravaned over the deserts of Nevada to form a new Jerusalem. Every single story that people have ever told about a promised land involves a long and arduous journey, and most of the time, the journey ends with dubious results at best. The promised land is not achievable without a journey. The promised land is not achievable unless somewhere along the way you get a little lost. And once you get there, the promised land is never quite as perfect as you thought it would be. I actually grew up as a kid in the shadow of a dead utopia. Isn't that just a dramatic way to think of me as a child brooding in the shadow of a dead utopia? I don't think I took it all that seriously then, but I think about it now, because I grew up just a few miles from a town called New Harmony, Indiana. And New Harmony, Indiana, is famous for nothing except that it is the site of two of America's grandest experiments and biggest failures in communal utopian living. See, in the 19th century, two different groups of people came to my little hometown and tried to carve the promised land out of the wilderness, and both times it flopped miserably. In 1814, a whole pile of people that were separatists from the German Lutheran Church, they called themselves the Harmony Society, they piled into flatboats and they floated down the Wabash River to that remote outpost in the Indiana Territory, and the plan was to go into the wilderness to carve out a perfect world, and to wait for Jesus to come and end it. That was the idea. They shared all their possessions in community. They lived in dormitories. They upheld a way of life that professed to hold all women and men as equals in the eyes of God, which is why I have always been confused that the only mansion in town is the one that their founder and religious leader built for himself. Utopia is never quite what it seems. The Harmony Society lasted just over 10 years, finally bailing back east and selling out to another group of hopeful utopians, these ones led by an agnostic scientist and intellectual named Robert Owen. Robert Owen, incidentally, was a friend to a lot of Unitarians, and his idea was that he would take southern Indiana and he would make of it an intellectual promised land where the pursuits of the mind would overcome all the people's petty squabbles about property and wealth. Of course, petty squabbles about property and wealth were among the forces that caused that Owen utopia to fall apart almost as soon as it began. There's a novel that was once really popular, an Elizabeth Taylor movie was made about it. It's called Rain Tree County, and it was inspired by my hometown in New Harmony. And its author said of this place that people were invited to come and join a paradise regained by innate human goodness. The noble experiment lasted 2 years and collapsed in the usual picturesque wreck of innate human selfishness and inefficiency. The usual picturesque wreck. We recognize it. The same old story. The promised land receding further and further away over a distant horizon. It's always far away. Such is the fate of promised lands, and such has always been the fate of utopias. There were even some utopias that were designed specifically by and for our forebears. There's a specifically Unitarian utopia that was founded outside of Boston. It was called Brook Farm. And Ralph Waldo Emerson was one of its financial backers. And UU legend says that Nathaniel Hawthorne spent time at Brook Farm, and he would go out in the morning and pitchfork hay before coming back in the afternoon to labor over his books. What UU history doesn't always highlight is the fact that Hawthorne lasted about 2 weeks at Brook Farm. Along with the rest of his utopian friends, he found out shortly that he really preferred to pay servants to pitchfork the hay. And so, like the experiments of my hometown, Brook Farm didn't last long either. Utopian attempts were everywhere in the 19th century. They pop up all over the place in the history of our inherently hopeful denomination. In 1840, Emerson himself wrote that, "Not a reading man but has a draft of a new community in his waistcoat pocket." Everybody believed it was possible. Some people, like the Harmony Society, thought that perfection would come from Jesus, and some folks, like Robert Owen and our forebears, thought it would come through human effort, and neither panned out. And here we are. Moses has stood atop the mountain. He has seen the place we're headed, and he has professed his faith that we could make it there. All our forebears have taught us that we have the power to make of this world a more peaceful place filled with justice, and yet here we are with the promised land getting further and further away. We've been lost in the wilderness now for more than a generation, and nothing's looking like it's going to be perfect anytime soon. I actually used to be a tour guide in New Harmony, and I would spend my days talking on and on about the courage and the bravery and all these things of our hopeful and optimistic forebears. And at the end of all the tours, the only word that I could seem to think of when I pondered the fact that selfishness caused the end of these experiments were those dramatic words of Macbeth's oration, the most poetic nihilism I've ever heard. "Out, out, brief candle, life is but a walking shadow. A poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." On some level, I felt that all of the stories of our hopeful forebears and their dreams of perfections were tales told by idiots. Because when you look and you see, the promised land is no closer than it was then. The candles have gone out, but the tale goes on. It was wonderfully dramatic in the shadow of a dead utopia, thinking about nihilism and Macbeth. It was really nice, but the truth is that I'm no more a nihilist than I am a utopian. And life may not signify peace and perfection, but it certainly doesn't signify nothing. I'm often fond of casting myself as someone who is not an idealist. And last week we had the Reverend David McPherson, who has been a UU minister for like 55 years, and he came to church here and he sat in the front row, and he didn't talk to anybody, but you might have seen him. And he has this way of just cutting to the quick of everything. And when David shook my hand on his way out of the sanctuary last Sunday, he said, "You say you're not an idealist, but you are, or you wouldn't be standing up there. And I said, right. Right. Busted. I don't know what the promised land looks like for you. I don't know what it looks like in your own soul. Maybe it's something as grandiose as world peace. Maybe it's finally quitting smoking. Maybe it's picking up the pieces of a broken heart, shining light into the wilderness of a hurting relationship. Maybe the promised land is something as complex in its simplicity as finally being happy in your own skin. Maybe it's just finally being content in the life you live. Maybe the promised land that is uniquely yours also feels like it just keeps getting further away, and you wonder in your own kind of wilderness, in the shadow of your own dead utopias, waiting for the day when things will be whole again. Maybe there's something broken inside you that you hope beyond hope might one day be made whole. What the stories of the promised land teach us is that the promised land is not easy to get to, and that it's not perfect once you get there. For no perfect society has ever existed. No perfect marriage has ever been blessed. Nobody ever quit smoking without hating it. And no perfect child has ever been born. But I am idealistic enough to believe that good societies happen from time to time. And marriages that challenge us as well as nurture us. And children so beautiful as to make one believe in God, even if they spend more time crying than cooing. I am idealistic enough to remember that all of those things have existed. And if every utopia ever founded crumbles to dust, as all utopias have so far, and if every promised land and perfect life stays just outside of our eager grasping, even if we never find the answers to our burning questions, as I suspect we won't, I believe there is meaning enough in the wilderness for us all. Life will never be all that we hope it will be, and holiness and perfection and peace may never reign entirely supreme, but our lives can bend in the direction of hope. And on most days, for most hungry hearts, that will be enough. Do I believe that the bright light of day will always shine, and people won't be hurt, and our inherent worth and dignity will mean that someday we get it all together? Nope. But I'd rather turn with all my soul toward the promised land, climb high atop a mountain, and see hope stretched out before me, then turn my back simply because I may never get there entirely. Even if the journey goes on and on, I'd rather turn my steps in the direction of peace than give up just because the golden horizon keeps receding in front of me. You know, there was another man who led a people toward freedom. Another man who never lived to see that freedom himself. You know, he was Martin Luther King, and on the night before he was killed, his last sermon was about Moses. His words speak for themselves. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it doesn't matter to me now, because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would love to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about all that now. I just want to do God's will, and He's allowed me to go up to that mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know that we as a people will get to that promised land, and I am happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And that was the last sermon he ever preached. We may never get there completely. The realization of all of our dreams may well stay just over the horizon forever. But the journey continues, and progress is real. So let us go to the mountaintop. Let us see the stretching lands before us, and let us squint long enough and hard enough so that the shape of hope will still form on our horizons. Let us turn our steps in the right direction, even if we never do quite get there ourselves. May it be so.